neat, don't you think?
Hmm.
What?
Not the way I'd have done it.
Oh, really?
No, I'm not saying it's not clever, but...
What?
Bit... disappointed.
Everyone's a critic.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 19 for the week of February 3rd, 2014. I am Deerstalker David T. Cole, and I'm here with Blue Carbuncle, Sarah D. Bunting.
Tally-ho, Governor.
Baskerville Hound Tara Ariano. And unfortunate facial hair, John Ramos.
Are you really going to keep that?
Carbuncle.
Sure. That's an excellent segue into welcoming our honored guest this week. Welcome back, John Ramos.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Sarah D. Bunting. I appreciate that. Very glad to be here. Thank you, Tara and Dave.
So, Sherlock concluded Series 3 last night as of this recording. As we record this, I felt like we had been waiting for like 2 years, which we may have been, for it to return. And we'll probably be waiting another 5 years for it to come back because Cinnamon Bundersnatch and Et Al are very busy with film and other commitments. Watson is the Hobbit, as we all know. But it could have been the long time between seasons, but I was a bit let down by Series 3. I was wondering if anyone shared my opinion or if you guys really loved what they did with the latest three-pack of movies, basically, is what they are.
Why don't we start with anyone? Our guest?
Sure. Well, I watched this last one twice, the second time this morning, and I was struck by how much I would have been fine with just that episode being the season. The first two, I felt like, almost could have been excised, really. I didn't think anything super important happened. Yes, there was the reveal of how he died, which wasn't really a reveal.
Yeah. Well,
how he didn't die, I mean, and wasn't really a reveal. There was the wedding, which, you know, there were a couple of interesting flashbacks to it in the third episode. But that was more relationshipy than what I really watched the show for. I certainly thought the first two episodes could have been combined into one. And maybe it's partially also because there was so much stuff in the third episode that I'm excited about now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really loved how, you know, I don't know about you guys. I'm pretty sure I've talked to Sarah about this before. But I hate when, you know, on spy shows or mystery shows or whatever, when the wife is like just kept completely in the dark.
And oh,
it's
yeah,
not
yeah.
Credible and
yes.
You know, and now not only did they tell her all the secrets that are going on, but like they actually forged like kind of a blood oath with her at this point. You know, so she's like super into what's going on. And you know, spoiler, I guess, with the return of Moriarty, I feel like her skill set is going to be too valuable for her to sit on the sidelines.
Mm-hmm.
So. That I thought was really cool, you know, and Moriarty also, you know, Sherlock's return to the from the grave is part of the original stories. Moriarty stayed dead.
Hmm.
So right now they're setting themselves up to be completely off the chain of the source material. And that I think could be exciting. It could also be grim.
Right.
I think in the case of this Moriarty, it's a great decision. Like when he was in his mind palace in the last one, and Moriarty was sort of like he's visiting Moriarty,
yes.
Who isn't dead there. I was like, God, I miss that guy.
Yeah.
That actor was so good.
And in the source material, Moriarty is confined to like one long story, basically, you know, whereas in this one, they've thread him through the whole series. So, you know, they've deepened that relationship a lot. So I'm on board with it, definitely, you know. Could go to shit like anything else, but I think they know what they're doing.
Yeah, it's interesting you said the first two episodes could have been one for you. And, you know, now that you said that aloud, I'm like, yeah, that could have worked, you know, with a deft editor's hand going for it. You know, this series was obviously very fan service-y.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
With the, you know, the near kiss dream sequence, all the fan in the show meta fan commentary about how, you know, Sherlock could have faked his own death and, the hashtags in it and all that kind of stuff. It was winky fun, I thought. And I said this at the time, but I enjoyed those first two episodes because they were fun and goofy. Watson and Sherlock having that drunken escapade, you know, being out of character. I love that in the same way I love when Marge Simpson gets drunk and out of, you know what I mean? It pushed the same button for me.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you look at the episodes, as John was saying, that are more about detective work than the relationship. And the relationship is an important part of it for sure. But, you know, the heart of those first two episodes wasn't a case. It was, you know, the domestic, you know, stuff. And I think these episodes are going to do very well with the fan base, but are kind of going to quickly fade into the mist or kind of forgettable in so far, like as a Sherlock entity to me.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely, it puts the show more into the,
Can I use my calorie thing? It's a little bit of empty calories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but yeah. It puts the show more into, for better or worse. I mean, it's a very good example of the genre, but it's definitely now in the genre category with like Supernatural and like those kind of shows that really hammer on a particular dyad.
Not that
now
I've watched
a triad
a lot of...
with Mary, and I agree with John that they've like made her more of a person, yeah. which is great.
Yeah.
Certainly more so than in the Robert Downey Jr. movies where she was just a normal boring drip.
Yeah.
But but yeah, I mean, they were fun to watch, but they don't necessarily stand up to a huge amount of scrutiny. And the fact that there's going to be this long, long, long wait, no doubt, is probably good because it can sort of let you like forget what was wrong with these episodes and just be excited for it.
And I didn't hate them. I didn't think there were bad episodes.
No, I didn't hate them either. It just comparatively. And yeah. I remember when The Sopranos came back for season four and everyone's like, what a disappointment. This is a disaster. And when you rewatch it, it's like there's some dogs in there. But there's some dogs in season two.
Yeah.
There's a couple dogs in season one. Like The Sopranos was not this perfect egg that went bad because it was on the shelf for too long. That is a terrible metaphor, but I committed to it. Here we are with an egg. Yeah. That's what she said. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
But it occurred to me in the middle of the wedding episode that it was like, this is a little bit too pleased with itself.
It's a little Comic-Con-y. That would be the analogy that I would go for. You know what I mean?
Exactly,
like it puts it in that category where it's like, you know, with Scott Pilgrim and like, you know what I mean? Nothing against Scott Pilgrim, but you know what I mean.
Well, like, when you have three episodes in a season and you have two episodes of that ilk, you're kind of throwing the balance off on what the series is about. Mm-hmm. And certainly when you look at series three as a whole,
yes.
And you have 2/3 of it being this, you know, the wedding and the Back from the Dead stuff.
Yeah.
That it kind of throws it off kilter. And when you come up to episode three with Mickelson in it, mm-hmm. and then you're like, oh, okay, this is
classic Sherlock.
Got my ass in the seat in the first place.
Yeah, yeah.
You feel a little cheated is a strong word, but I feel like I wanted, as John said, the domestic stuff one episode and then give us another case.
Yeah. I mean, Stephanie in her particle on the finale referred to it as season squee, which is like, yep, that's mm-hmm. perfect. That's mm-hmm. exactly what it is.
That's a great term. Yeah.
Not to be overly critical either, because I think like taking an emotional beat after the death is fine. I think it was just human. And maybe part of the reason was I found the mystery alongside the wedding really weak.
Yes.
Really weak. Yeah. Surprisingly weak. Yeah.
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 So
absolutely.
If they could have distracted me a little bit from the emotion with actual, like, real, much better detective work, like in season two, I would have been much more fine with it, I think. But
and at least as an American, I think part of what is so touching and striking to me about their bromance or whatever mm-hmm. is that they're very British about it, and mm-hmm. it wasn't foregrounded as much. Like, of course John was destroyed by what he thought was Sherlock's death, and of course he was enraged by Sherlock being alive and sort of making a joke out of it and being like, what, behold my tiny mustache and my French accent. And that was fine, and exploring all that is fine, and he's a good enough actor, they both are, that you get at that. But the throwaway moments between them about their closeness, and that, you know, on some level, each one of them is the only one the other one can relate to.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like that was more resonant with me when we were just seeing it kind of in the corners.
Yeah.
And it wasn't an entire episode that's like, you know, cue the cellos of romantic reunion. Like, yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then the next episode is like, and how will the woman, in, you know, how is Mary going to Yoko this? Like, well, you know, she seems kind of cool. And they, you know, they brought that back. And again, it's not like I disliked any of these, but particularly the middle one, I was kind of like, I don't know, like I was working on something else while I was watching it, which is pretty rare for me with this show.
Maybe not a bromance, but a romates.
Uh-huh.
Because they're British.
Right. And I'm not gay mance.
Well, you know, part of it, as you say, with them bringing to the forefront and really doing a lot of work on the relationship is that if their grand plan is to sort of make this more of a, you know, a party of three, then maybe they kind of just wanted to be done with that. Well, not be done with it, but
yeah,
you know, have at it and then, you know, not have to worry about
and then they never
it
have
not
to do
being
it again.
Addressed later.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
And I hope they have a very good nanny that can just take this baby wherever. So we never have to see it or care about it.
I know. Yes. That's why I want her to get out of the suburbs. Walt. I feel like she can effectively now, yeah. Like with her spy, with her, you know, former assassin skills or whatever.
Totally. So, let's talk about Lars Mikkelsen, because I know the three of us in L.A.
Absolutely.
Love him from Borgen.
Absolutely. Oh, my God. I was just thinking, you know, when Holmes was talking about, you know, his resemblance to a shark. You
yeah.
Know, the dead eyes and everything. He was so, I don't know, romantic and sensitive on Borgen, and to mm-hmm. see him like stripped of all that and like, you know, licking Lindsay Duncan's face, which like
he was kind of
Mr.
a mercenary
bodily fluids here,
politician and like. Forbedelsen, the killing.
Yes.
On from Denmark.
Yeah, he's the mayoral candidate in the first season of the original killing.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, quite a range between Sherlock and that, I mean, just like, I mean, between that and Borgen.
Yes.
Yeah. That was, yeah.
And I should say,
he's,
too,
I love him. He's great.
On that character subject, you know, I was going to bring up a little bit about how much they've tied the source material
yes, please.
Into this. A lot of it is very winky or like throwaway stuff. You know, they'll throw in, like, from the first season, I think it was Holmes talking about, like, this is a three-patch problem. That was a play on a three-pipe problem from the original. You know, there's a lot of winky stuff like that.
In season three, his going, becoming a junkie plotline.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, that was lifted, like, he actually, that beginning setup, Watson actually does go find, it's a friend's husband, not son, but in an opium den rather than a meth house or whatever that was.
Yeah.
But usually they're fairly throwaway. They're clever. You know, sometimes they'll meld two things together. But what was great about this one was that Charles Augustus Magnuson here was actually a character in the original called Charles Augustus Milverton, Adventures of Charles Augustus Milverton. He was very similar and very well drawn. He was the, you know, king of the blackmailers. And I think in the original episode, he likened him to a serpent instead of a shark. But it's pretty spot
either way.
On. It's updated in this modern way, but it's pretty spot.
And it's Murdoch-y also.
Right.
Which
he blackmailed people. He, you know, caused them to kill themselves, you know, often by exposing them. He does die in the original. Holmes does not kill him, but he's kind of adjacent to the death. But I thought that update was really good because beyond Moriarty, Milverton is definitely one of the people that Holmes hates and feels, you know, an adversarial relationship with the most, even though it's only one story. So I thought that was very clever.
And they tease him in the first episode, and I find it kind of felt cheated because we only ever did get one episode's worth of him doing anything. Like, that teaser didn't need to be in the first episode at all. Like, he didn't really.
Yeah, I thought about that too.
Yeah, you know, and I kind of wish
it felt tacked on a little bit.
If they kind of rejiggered the priorities of the series a bit, he could have had a two episode arc, or at least could have had his tendrils in the episode before it in some sort of way that they have done previous series.
Yeah,
but
that,
you know,
said,
I was,
character
he was great. Yeah, amazing.
I was thinking about when he like leads the Dungeon Fest. I was like, well, she's used to it. She was on Rome, you know?
Right. And she was near worse things happening when she worked for the Prime Minister on Black Mirror, too.
Yeah,
that's true.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
absolutely true. Yeah, but he was great. You know, he What I really liked was that he foiled Holmes at every turn, and Holmes was really left with the only, you know, the final solution, you know, was the only way he could solve it.
That was such a nice moment for Cumberbatch, too, who I think can probably coast most of the time in this series because it's very popular and he is going to work. You know, he doesn't necessarily need this. But what he was doing was sort of the play of his face being like, enraged, like frustrated and enraged that he's been outfoxed, but also almost laughing. Like there's that sort of amused admiration at the same time.
Yeah.
For someone who can outsmart him or like play on his level that we haven't seen since, you know, Moriarty, actually. And even then, he was more just straight up annoyed with Moriarty or perhaps with himself for, you know, getting outsmarted.
Well, also like that, there was the scene, the back, you know, how to fall down after the gunshot extended, you know, Dream Palace, not Dream Palace, right. Mind Palace scene, which is sort of the same thing, you know, it's Sherlock out of his element in danger. I thought that scene went a little too long. The same with the scene of him being drunk, first going to the bar and then dealing with the client. What seemed to go on for a while.
Yeah.
It seemed to me like they may have started with one episode, John, and kind of ended up with two episodes just because they had these ideas like, you know, it was sort of felt like their Temple of Doom, you know, like let's make Indiana Jones, let's dress him up in a white suit, you know, let's make Sherlock drunk, you know, here's our wish list of things that we could do that, destroy people's impression of what that character is all the time.
But it just kept going. Like the Wolf of Baker Street.
Yes.
But in this episode they definitely went back to what makes the show great quickly. Like the reveal, I thought, like, and this is another somewhat homage to the original, is when they're in the when he brings her to the old facade of a house, basically, and confronts her. That's kind of a set of, there's actually the adventure of the empty house, where Holmes sets up, you know, to watch an adversary that he thinks is gonna attack Baker Street, basically. But so that is all familiar, and the dummy part is familiar, but the double reverse twist is that it wasn't actually a dummy, it was Watson, you know.
So. Yeah.
And the look on her
face.
Yeah,
that was very elegantly done. Yeah. I'd
they Harlow Globetrotter,
I guess, but yeah.
If I were gonna write a that moment on previously TV, it's where she realizes that he's behind her and she doesn't want to turn around because she doesn't want to confirm it. But that was just great work, I thought. I really liked it.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, the third episode really is like, okay, good.
Yes.
All right, series four, back on track. I really want to do it. And again, it feels like we're all sort of like down on the first two episodes. And I think they were like dessert, but it was just like too much dessert.
Yep, they were fun to watch, but they're insubstantial.
Yeah.
Dessert is a good way to put it.
All right, anything else before we move on?
I don't think so.
All right,
see you. Sherlock, B+.
Yeah, see you in 3 to 4 years. All right, it's time to go around the dial, a little bit of a format to shake up on this one. Our intention was not to be so newsy, but to be a little more sort of items we want to talk about.
I'm sorry I perverted it.
I wasn't going to bring it up, but Tara fucked it up.
Forgiveness, please.
Yes.
All right, let's go first. I will go first. I just want to say I'm giving Helix the boot. I tried. I really
did.
Ron Moore show, his first, you know, big project since Battlestar Galactica. And even though I keep on going on about the end of Battlestar Galactica and how disappointed it was.
Most
of the series, I'm still mad about it, but most of that series was really good.
Yes.
So pretty excited about Helix. It sounded like it had the DNA of a good show. Thank you very much. Arctic setting, which we've talked about on the podcast before, which why don't more people use it? It's so creepy.
Yep.
It's a story of
Thing like,
yeah, exactly. it's sort of like TV Thing. Instead of monsters, it's more about, you know, maybe the military is involved, it's that kind of thing.
You mean The Thing, the movie, as opposed to Thing from Fantastic Four?
Yes.
Yeah.
Adam's Family.
Yeah. Continue. That's
my problem, but my problem with Helix is, and I said this on Twitter, is the whole show only moves forward when what you are supposed to buy as smart characters do extremely dumb things. It's the only time things happen in that show. And that's like, at the base level, makes the show extremely irritating to watch.
Yeah.
And it just keeps on going on that cycle. Like, everybody in this base, there's not maybe like, there's one goony security guy. Like, he's the only one that really should make the stupid mistake. He's the one's like, I'm going to lick the inside of your mouth or something. Like, okay, fine. But everybody else should be, you know.
Wait, Lars Mikkelsen was on that show?
If only.
Oh my God,
yeah,
if only.
That scene, I forgot. So, yeah, got to give Helix
well, and there's also that sense, I will be continuing to watch it for reasons that don't bear getting into.
Like, you love frozen monkeys.
Yes, you know me and frozen monkeys. A monkey-sicle is my favorite thing. but there is this sense that, like, Billy Campbell came dressed to play, and he's giving it 110%, and it's like, you know, the big star comes to, you know, dinner theater in the right. in the country. Everyone else is just kind of like, I don't know, it's not great.
There
and
is a disparity of talent
very
there,
slow.
For sure. Yeah.
This is not the best acting that Canada has to offer.
Yes, very.
If I may.
No, yeah, it's a bulk. They got a bulk discount on the acting Canada had to offer. It yeah. was Costco Canada acting. But yeah. Yeah,
is anyone else
not.
On the show that the layman would know? Or?
The Takeda from Revenge.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Is
yeah.
on
He's
it.
The worst.
Original Takeda, right?
He's the bad guy. Yes.
Yes, yeah. Young Takeda. Yeah.
Yes. Sorry. The one with the mustache, right. Not the other one.
All right. Well, Sarah, you can let me know if it gets better because I ain't watching anymore.
Okay. Nothing about Black
Holding
Sails?
Your breath won't be necessary.
Okay. Yeah, I also stopped watching Black Sails because after the first episode, it just got super boring. So.
I fell asleep in the second one and asked Dave the next day, what happened on Black Sails? And he was like, I don't even remember.
I really don't. There was maybe a gunfight? I don't know. Doesn't matter.
There was not a gunfight in the season finale of The Carey Diaries over the weekend, which may have been the series finale. And I wrote a piece for Previously TV in which I said that I hoped that wasn't the case because I think that the show would be one of the rare high school shows that survives the transition to a college venue. And here's why. The show was never exactly about the high school experience. That wasn't really the brief. It was about Carey and how she wound up in the city originally and her adventures at Interview Magazine. And also, you know, her home life and her sister and stuff going on with high school and her high school friends. But because that wasn't the entire basis and not all the characters were there, I think it could transition to college because she would be going to NYU. My new favorite character, Donna LaDonna, got into Columbia for yep. some reason. If that's just a Hail Mary to be like, no, seriously, we can bring them all into New York and it's NBD. Like, I approve this yep. message because Donna LaDonna is the best. And even if she's the only one that keeps being on the show and they just turn it into like Donna LaDonna in space, PI, I don't care.
Well,
they
and West,
really turned
her
around.
They sent West to Princeton, right? That's not so far.
Yes, they did.
I mean, he's only a side character, but still.
Yeah. I mean, 20 minutes on the dinky and then another hour and a half on New Jersey Transit. John, back me up here. I just think it's a really good show. It's not like anything groundbreaking or sort of, you know, homework TV or premium cable. It's not True Detective, but it's not trying to be. And it really loves its characters, and I think that that could easily continue into college and not feel really contrived in terms of which characters would continue on the show. I think it does pretty well in a Friday night time slot. The CW has some room to be forgiving, so I mean, not to be one of those like, send them Tabasco sauce or whatever it is people used to do, but I don't know. It's a good show.
I was most happy that Sebastian is gone because I always thought that kid was bullshit.
Well, we know he's not going to continue. I don't have any interest in figuring out. Like, I am interested in why, when some of these characters are so awesome, and also her dad and sister, like, they all seem to get along, and yet yeah. we never heard about them in Sex and the City Mark 1. So, I'm kind of interested to see how that would evolve. Like, why don't we know Dorit? She's way better than Carey, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well,
but, yeah, I mean, Sebastian is sort of like, he was kind of the Pierce. He didn't offend me. He's he's pretty, but the show doesn't need him and probably can't afford him given their music budget being 95% of the line item. So yeah, good luck, Carrie Diaries. We're pulling for you.
Well, the Carrie Diaries may not be True Detective, but you know what is True Detective is True Detective.
Oh!
That's what she said.
So I had a thought that since the show is off this week, we have a chance to slow down and kind of pause for a different issue. Here's my I am not a crackpot hashtag preface. I think there should be a joint acting award. Let's say for the Emmys, or, you know, probably start with the Emmys and see if it takes. But Woody Harrelson,
they
and
have
Matthew
that
McConaughey,
at the SAG Awards, right?
They have an ensemble award.
They have ensemble awards, yeah. But ensemble awards just basically typically go to some show that they like and probably are going to honor in another capacity. This is, this I feel should be a serious award because Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson are both so good and are both doing such different things that what happens between them is almost its own character, I think is the way I would probably put it. And I wanted to see what you guys thought about an award, you know, for a two-person performance that couldn't happen otherwise. And maybe if there are any other shows in the past that you can think of.
I can think of lots. Like Raylan
and Boyd.
And Boyd on Justified.
Yeah.
Like the two of them are a good team. Of antagonists and protagonists, mm-hmm. depending on the day, really. Yeah, I can see that taking off.
If MTV can do duo awards, why can't the Emmys? Right?
Yeah.
I mean, they have all those ones, you know. So
mm-hmm. I just think this is a pair of performances that keeps kind of, I wouldn't say one-upping each other, but just building.
No, but they
on
inform
the best
each
of the
other.
Other one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So far,
they haven't really been tempted to make them like each other anymore. Like right. they yes. understand each other better, but it's not like. They end up having a beer together and, you know, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun.
Yeah.
They're still kind of antagonistic.
It's a model of toleration.
Yeah, even in the flash-forward episodes, it's clear, like, there's still bad blood between them. Like, yeah. even though they probably haven't seen each other in this whole time since the case, they still kind of seem like they can't stand each other.
Totally. And I love, that's enforced. I think I put this in a comment on PTV, but it's enforced by the way that they're always side by side instead of facing each other.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's like they're just like giving each other like these, I hate you side eyes, like every time they talk, basically. I don't know.
No big hug mug for Woody Harrelson.
No big hug mug for Woody Harrelson.
Finally, American Horror Story wrapped up its third season, Coven. Last week, and we finally got the answer to who is the supreme of the coven, and it's Cordelia. What? That was the most, not only very disappointing, like whatever, she's a fine character, but it completely contradicts all of the rules that it set up for what the supreme is from the very first episode when she was the one who said what a supreme is and isn't. So for that, finally to like just come all the way around to like, no, everyone can die and come back to life and still be a candidate despite the radiant, glowing health requirement seems weird to me.
And also, they didn't really need a supreme. They just needed a director of marketing, apparently.
right. Yes. To go on and get interviewed by Kyle Segor on CNN or whatever network that was supposed to be. I mean, I feel like it should have been Misty. Even though she came back from the dead too, but that was her whole thing. That was her power.
And they really sent her off with like nothing. It was just like
she couldn't cut a frog open.
Yeah. That was my least favorite thing in the entire disappointing finale. I mean, just the care that had gone into crafting that character. I just was like, what is the fucking message or point here? You know, at the end,
and
I just felt like
I thought the last episode would see the corporeal return of Nan, but. That she would be acknowledged in some way because
they had a shot of her for a second. Okay. When Queenie is like throwing bones in that montage at the beginning, she's in front of a picture of Nan. That was it. You're right.
But the last moment was the butler and the caretaker guy. Mm-hmm. What's his name?
Spalding.
Yes, Spalding and her. And it seemed like he was like, you're going to like it here. We can do some stuff. And I'm like, okay, well, that'll be interesting. The stuff they do.
Yep.
Thread.
Yeah, there was a lot of ideas raised that never went anywhere, and like normally that didn't bother me that much in season two
because it was like, ask
such a crazy mess that it was fun.
Okay,
but here I felt like there was more of an effort to like t- tell a cohesive story that just at the end they were like, ah, forget it.
Yeah. It seemed like they may have started writing the last few episodes as they were filming the first few episodes or something.
Yeah.
Because I haven't seen the other season, so that was going to be my question, whether this sort of randomness and sort of plot pourri, mm-hmm. if I may coin that term, is
sure
normal for the show.
I personally felt like in season two, yeah, I agree that they are so committed to plot. It's like trying to land on, you know, trying to end the season on a coherent spot is like having your DVR fast forwarded like to 10 and then like trying to push the right spot.
Right.
But yeah. In season two, I still felt like they paid off a bunch of themes. Like,
yeah, definitely.
Know, evil reverting to itself, sins of the father revisited on the son, mm-hmm. you know, stuff you felt like, oh, you know, they it wasn't just a slice of life and death like season mm-hmm. three was.
Yeah.
So,
all right. Let's like who, what's your choice for Supreme, John? What would have been your choice?
Oh, Misty, absolutely.
Yeah, Misty for sure.
Yeah.
Sarah?
I stopped watching after the third episode. I didn't care for what they were doing. So Misty, I guess.
Yeah.
She's the bitch who wanted to flip the bus?
No, that was Madison. Misty was the Stevie Nicks obsessed one.
Oh, well, I like that actress. She was kind to me when I interviewed her, so
that's
yes,
right.
Misty.
And Dave?
Yeah, I agree.
Well,
all right.
I'm sure Lily Rabe will be back in whatever the next season is.
Yeah. All right.
I hope so. She's the bomb.
All right. It is time for The Canon. And John Ramos, as our guest, you were invited to submit something to the Extra Hot Great Canon. What do you got?
Well, thank you, Dave. I have Survivor Season 2, Episode 1. Episode 7, excuse me, The Merge. Getting back on the reality show train that was derailed a couple episodes ago. Justly or unjustly, I don't know. Thanks, Mark Blankenship. So this season, I was interested to know it actually because I wouldn't have guessed this, that this season is still the highest rated Survivor season
ever.
Is
that right?
Yeah.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Very interesting, I find.
It was a good season.
You know, it's hard to pick, obviously, for 27 seasons, it's hard to pick out maybe, you know, and I haven't watched, you know, I don't think I've even watched half of them. I'm not actually the biggest reality person, so I'm kind of surprised I'm doing this, but
are you going to Joe Reed Saturday Night Live?
No, I'm really not actually. The reason I think this episode, this season and this episode are so great is that it shows without a bunch of bells and whistles why this premise was great.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a parallel right now, I think, with American Idol, which I don't watch anymore and I'm not going to go back to. But a lot of people are super psyched about this season because they got rid of the stupid auditions, finally the gimmicky stuff, which, like, that stuff to me always was like watching Let's Make a Deal, basically. Like, you know, you got a bunch of people up there acting like idiots to try to get on camera for 5 minutes. And American Idol, I think they didn't even get any shitty parting gifts. But... at its bones, I think Survivor is a really good show. Season one, you know, I don't think you really get... most shows are still working out production kinks. And, you know, and especially in Survivor, you know, as everyone knows, very few people actually knew how to play the game.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whereas in this one, they didn't have, you know, the benefit of a handbook of like 10 seasons or whatever. But they knew enough to go in and start planning their strategy. And everyone is essentially on equal footing, I think.
Do you know, out of curiosity, if this season started filming before the end of the first season? They must have seen some Survivor, at least.
I would think they probably did.
I would think so.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because I...
So they're going into it with eyes open.
I mean, right. Survivor season, the first season ended, like, in August. And this one's...
Well, I remember the reunion of the first one, and it was like, okay, it's the big reveal. Where's the second season going to be? And I was, like, genuinely excited. Like, what the...
Well,
like,
yeah. I can't imagine. It started, like, early in 2000.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and the production dates for this one are, like, January to May 2001.
Oh, okay.
So it was definitely out. You know, yeah. People knew. So, you know... Fuck off, Redemption Island, Exile Island.
Yeah.
Figure out how to jerk off without the cameraman watching you, Island. I liked this original iteration. And in my get off my lawn points, I really liked that people did not have hurt feelings about playing the game in the season. Did not we're always essentially thinking about the game. There aren't really many weak links, except maybe Amber, but she does kind of make up for it later in her survivor career.
She won.
There's no
shaming, reflects it.
There's no shaming women for the same gameplay relative to men in this season, which I really like. And there are many, there's no obvious tribal council influencing from Jeff Probst. And there are many kind of presented without comment moments where the show kind of trusts you to see the humor in what's going on or the strategy. So, and you can clearly see the acts, like, thank you, Mark Blankenship. But dramaturgically speaking, I think if you were to read this as a script, I think it would be a page turner. Like, you're like, oh, this is, you know, there's not a lot of fat. It moves along. You know, I'm interested in what's happening to these characters. So the episode itself, coming in, you have two teams that are damaged. One of them, you know, kind of literally, because Michael Scoopin before this episode had just fallen in the fire at Kucha. So Kucha was a team that was, you know, kind of dominating. They had this great camp, lots of food, really got along. You know, the couple times they voted people out, there were people that they hated. So, you know, everything was pretty chill at their camp. Okagura had this, you know, they hadn't won many challenges. They were, their camp was like, so sad, God. And they'd already had one big kind of betrayal moment with Mitchell when Jerry and Amber.
So good.
Yeah.
Right.
Jerry and Amber thought that they were leading the, and Mitchell, I guess, thought that they were leading the tribe, and Colby flipped over to Tina and Keith and completely turned the power dynamics of that tribe on its head. So that team is more like psychologically fragmented at this point. But going into the merge with both teams even, which rarely happens, they still knew that their original team was their best shot, especially since they haven't had a chance to socially intermingle with the other. And I also like this point in the season because they've trimmed a certain amount of fat, but it's not like where it's down to like three or four people where it's the same over and over again and people are getting kind of overexposed. You know, you have 10 people in this episode, and I would argue that 9 of them have a big role in it. The episode starts. Start in Kucha. There's a discussion of whether they can sway any Okagorians. Kind of decide that they probably can't, even though they correctly target that Jerry might be a weak link. But what I like about that, too, is that I hate it when people flip in this game without any plan of what's going to happen after that. Like, when people promise, like, oh, we'll take care of you, don't worry. But there's just a vague plan, you know? It's like, of course Lex, Boston Rob, was going to vote you out afterward. How could it not be in his interest to do so, you know? Another hurt feelings one, yeah.
Yeah.
So everyone at Kucha is talking strategy. You know, they're throwing ideas around. They're all thinking, maybe not the way I would do it in all cases, but, you know, it's very strategy-oriented. And then the big point of this episode, I think one of the biggest plot points of this episode is the previous vote, which comes up. So let's play clip one.
I'm listening to y'all talking. It's me. Plus Kimmy on the first reward challenge, they asked who Deb voted for. And Kimmy said Jeff. So yeah, they know that I have a vote against me.
We're anticipating a 5-5 tie in the first vote. And in the rules, when there's a deadlock tie, the person with the most votes accumulated to that point is the one to leave.
You think they remember, Jeff? Because I had totally forgotten about that.
It's never left my mind.
If they remember that, that's...
But then again, that's a vote against me, so it wouldn't leave my mind.
So, in addition to giving the information about the vote, which, in case you weren't familiar with the rules at that time, if there was a deadlock, they did a revote. If there was still a deadlock, then whoever had the most votes cast against them at tribal council before would go home. I like that rule because it gave even, you know, the Debs of the world some kind of potential influence over the vote, and it's better than like fucking making a fire after, you know, you've been standing on a on a poll for 10 hours and then go to tribal council,
which is how they do. Oh no, now they draw rocks, right?
I think they draw rocks, which is even dumber. Yeah,
fire was in between.
Opinion. Yeah, fire
but
was
the
in
two
between.
People now, the way it works is the two people that have the that are tied, both of them are out of it, right?
I actually don't know that. That may
I think
be
I remember that from Joe's recaps.
That would be
of this season.
That would be
but
interesting.
That, anyway, continue. Not relevant here.
But yeah, but the one other part I like about that clip is Nick's like, oh, do you think they remember that? Because he had forgotten about it, you know, but it's like the other team, you know, they don't know how much the other team paid attention to this information. So there's a very, like, through this whole episode, there's a very much, like, but do they know we know they know?
Right.
You know, kind of thing happening. So having visited with Kucha, we go over to Okagor, and they don't even know exactly what happened to Scoopin. So they're all kind of looking around like, well, is it okay that we're happy that we're, you know, going in 5-5? And then, so Colby basically sums up what's happening in clip two.
Yesterday, everything was canceled because of the accident with Kucha. You know, you're just left with days that seem like there's at least 19 to 20 hours of daylight.
We have no idea what's going on. I mean, we have no idea how drastic or serious the situation is with Kucha.
I hope whoever does is able to return.
Automatically, we assume the worst. Horrible. It's the worst part about this is waiting around for information.
That's like, you know, getting a phone call from the hospital saying, oh, we've got him here, but can't tell you what's wrong.
I didn't think Roger had a stroke or anything.
Oh, my gosh. Really?
Yeah.
We don't know anything. We don't know when we're merging. We don't know the condition of Kucha's member who's been in an accident. We don't know very much at all.
Tina's reaction is so great.
I know. Well,
and Roger having a stroke? Like,
he, I know.
I guess
53.
He seemed kind of old when it aired, but he's like, what is he, my age? Like, oh, God.
But Jerry, too, wow. Like, you know, I kind of like how she doesn't back off it either. She's just like, well, yeah. I don't know. Wasn't that horrible? So anyway, then they get mail that they have a boys' night out coming. So the boys of Kucha are of Okagor are going to go visit. They think the women of Kucha, but the show is instead pulling a switcheroo. And it's interesting because there's nothing really in the clue to lead them one way or another. So it's fun to watch their mental process at both camps about why they think this is going to happen. Because at Kucha, they think it's actually even deliberate. Like they want to keep the girls apart. Yeah, which is, you know, you could say it's not particularly logical, but they're, you know, they're out there in the middle of, you know, nowhere for 21 days. They've got nothing but their own brains to keep them company. So then they get to clip three. We can roll that.
It's important for us to get information right now about who's had votes cast against them, because it's probably going to come down to a tiebreaker vote.
We've got to be totally silent on who's had any votes.
Yes, we do have a lot at stake. If we slip anything out regarding the voting situation, we're done.
The only thing to break the tie is past votes for the person who was voted for. If they were to vote for myself or Keith, we'd be out.
So at this point, you know, Okagor is clinging to the fragile hope that they have that they know that Jeff has a vote. But they don't know how many votes he has. They don't know if that's their best play. And they also have two people who have multiple votes on their team. So it's very unclear what's going to happen. So they go have their dinner. They have their little funny moment where the men are extremely disappointed that it's the other men that are coming to them instead of the women. And what I like about that is that the women totally predict that and they like laugh about it. They're just like, those guys are going to be so effing disappointed. And it's totally true. But all these humor moments go back to strategy very quickly. And I really like that. I like how, because the stakes are so high in this particular episode, it really does determine which tribe is going to win. I like that they keep going back to the gameplay. So they head over, you know, act two is like the, you know, starts with the switcheroo and, you know, they were expecting the women and they spent some time together and, you know, they like each other. It's, I like how kind of human the characters are allowed to be. And Alicia, you know, who threatened to eternally wave her finger in Kimmy's face, is very, you know, kind of gracious in her approach to the Okagor tribe. So they hope that they're going to go to the Kucha camp, which is like presented as the, I don't know, that it's like Elysium where like Kucha is like the space station, you know, where everyone wants to go. And
they've got Okagor, a coconut radio.
Yeah. Okagor is like, Okagor is the hellbound earth where no one has healthcare and everyone has to work for like 20 hours a day. But you know, the show never told them they were going to get to go to Kucha. And in fact, they have to go somewhere else. And there's a, you know, a well, I like the production decision that they have 15 minutes just to get out of there because it creates energy. They're all like rushing around. They don't have time to talk strategy at this point. There's a whole thing with the matches, which I won't, you know, go into, but there are a couple presented without comment moments that I think are really funny. So then they get to the new beach where their tribe is going to be and have a little feast, find a little feast waiting for them. And that's where we go to clip five.
It's nice starting all over, starting on equal ground. And it was important to listen more than you talk. Find out what you're up against.
Oh, you guys, this is so great.
You know, it was really kind of interesting because in the middle of all this celebrating, this game is still being played every minute of every day.
My stomach's going, what is going on?
A little bit of shock happened. Right?
They seemed to be very nice, and I thought that it was all legitimate. And then I saw Colby and Jerry sort of sneak off and whispering. And then I saw Colby walk over to Keith, and then they start whispering, and they're like pointing at us and counting fingers like she's gonna go first and he's gonna go second. And it started. We weren't together 15 minutes and it started.
So two things about that clip. One, if every survivor coming on the show embroidered Tina's listen more than you talk on a throw pillow and took that as their luxury item, I think they would probably do better.
Yep.
What you don't see in that clip is when Jeff is talking about Colby and Keith and Jerry, those three are shown with very furtive looking shots, but without sound, you can just hear the music. So you get a really good idea of his POV there. And you have to remember, I think even in season two, even though the show was a big hit, it was still proving itself in certain ways. And the editors really had a lot of fun with it. The music choices are fun. There's a lot of energy here. Even though there are no super big gotcha moments, I think, it really does move along. And you're never allowed to forget too long what the stakes are in this episode. So, the stakes being set, we go to the immunity challenge. And it's a perfect challenge for this episode because they have to stand on, wooden planks for basically as long as they can. And whoever is the last standing wins immunity. So obviously there's a big combination of team and individual dynamics here. And it's a great challenge because, like, in a way they are all alone, but they're all up there together. And it really does show there's a physical element, but it really does come down to who wants it and needs it the most. So, you know, Nick and Colby drop out pretty early. Colby says his strategy is basically to get people to vote for him because he has no prior votes. It goes on, and when you get to about the 8-hour mark and the sun goes down, that's where I just almost want to kill myself just, you know, in sympathy at this point.
It really looks miserable.
And these people are dressed, you know, the guys are not wearing shirts, you know, the girls are wearing skimpy stuff at this point because, you know, during the day it was super hot, and probably no one thought it was going to go this long. So you really see who wants, and I personally, as like a gameplay nerd, would love to know the inner monologues of all these people at this time because they really like all they can be thinking about is like, what's going to happen if this happens? What's going to happen if this happens? How much more, you know, am I going to have? I was trying to figure out myself whether if I knew how long it was going to take, whether that would make it harder or easier.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if 10 hours is like, you know,
20 minutes is too much to stand up.
Well, and the other thing is, like, unlike other endurance challenges, it's not like over time, you know, then your platform gets smaller. It's just right. Like,
yeah, they add
the
a weight
same.
Or something
right.
like that.
Right.
It's just boring.
It's just
like
standing,
this immovable body.
Doing the exact same thing for 10 straight hours.
Like, some people were there over 10 hours. Like, how did they pee?
I thought about that.
They probably just peed. I'm sure they just peed. They're standing in the water.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true.
But.
It's
yeah.
true. I mean, there are moments, you know, I didn't mention it in the Scoop and Fire, but this game is hardcore. You know, there are reminders here. And I swear to God, like, forget hot coffee. If someone had given me hot hemlock, I think I would have drank it at that point. But regardless, it gets down to three people, Alicia, Tina, and Keith. And our last clip is what happens. So.
These people are crazy.
You guys know we gotta go to tribal council tonight?
Hey, Jeff.
Your faces.
say a lot. So here's what I have. Hot coffee or hot chocolate.
And a boat ride in.
And a boat ride in.
Coffee. I'm done.
All right.
I know.
Hey, Peter.
What?
Good. I need this.
I looked over at Keith, and Keith said, Tina, I need this one. In his heart, he must have really thought that he was going to get the votes cast against him.
Dad, I want coffee.
You get close. Hey, Tina. Coffee.
You're coming with me.
I am.
Oh, Tina's getting down.
It's the hardest thing I've ever done, to come in. Much harder to come in than stay out there, because I've been out there 10 hours.
I knew for our team that I needed to make that decision. So I stepped down and let him have it.
So this is the second of three huge strategic decisions that Tina was involved in this season, but it's the only one that she had complete control of, I think. And since she ends up winning, spoiler, you know, I think it has a big seasonal place as well. You know, this moment, thinking back on the season, I remember a lot of moments, and this is always the one that comes back to me the most.
Then after Keith asks Tina to get off the pillar, he does this whole victory arm thing, which is like...
He really milks it in a very ungracious way.
You didn't actually win. You just didn't lose.
It was cheese, I agree. And there are a lot of threads...
just disingenuous.
There are a lot of threads in this episode that show why...
No
Keith
one liked
not
Keith.
Super popular in the tribe, yeah. And it's like it's this veneer that is almost broken in many places. Like when he says like talks about cooking, and Colby like has to like kind of grip every muscle in his body not to roll his eyes, but he's not trying. But they couldn't let them know. They couldn't let the other team know that Keith was damaged. Otherwise, so at this point, Okagor has strengthened his position. Now Jerry is the only weak link, but it's still in doubt. So they go to tribal council. I didn't really want to clip from tribal council because, you know, we all know the music, which I love. But, you know, it's like they walk up, they walk back, they walk up, they walk back. So in the end, Colby's gambit, whether, you know, that was it. The show never really tells you exactly every iteration of what everyone was thinking, which I like too. You know, I don't know if Alicia stepped down in the end because she was really tired, or she thought maybe people would throw votes her way and they'd be okay. You don't know. But in the end, the Kuchi team votes for Colby, Okagor votes for Jeff, and Jeff is voted out. And you can see at the end, like, you know, two things I love about the end, even though we can't really clip it, is one, this is like the end of a two-part episode of The Fall of the House of Kucha, you know, where you see, like, they look like The Walking Dead. The four of them who are left look like The Walking Dead. They know they're done at this point. And the other part is that Jeff, like, high-fives Colby on the way out, and he's a total sport at the end, except... And when I told Joe Reed I was doing this episode, the first thing I got back in all caps was fucking Kimmy. And he's like, because of the big mouth of a former tribesmate, you know, this is my lot in life, but, you know, shit happens and that's the end. So, I think I, you know, kind of showed why I think, it's important seasonally, and it's, you know, kind of illustrative of what makes this game great. So I throw it out to you.
What's funny in when you know how it's, when you remember how it ends. I mean, I watched the season when it was on, but I certainly haven't watched it since then. And considering that Jeff knows he's a target potentially, he really quits the challenge pretty early.
I know.
Which
you
is
know,
weird.
It's hard to say because he says he knows he couldn't have done it. And in retrospect, he's probably right. But I don't know.
Because he left before people were even showing any kind of signs of exhaustion. Like, certainly the sun was still up at the time he quit.
That's true.
So that's
was
kind
there
of,
even food out by the time he quit? I don't think
yes.
there was.
Yes, he comes in for peanut butter and apples, I think.
Oh, but I remember being like, really? A healthy snack?
But he comes in and he takes like the giantest, he takes
that's
almost
right.
the entire
oh,
gob
right.
of peanut butter.
Dirty fingernails. Yeah, I remember that.
You know, it's hard to say. If he'd known for sure that he was being voted for,
right.
You don't know. You know, he thought he might have been, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know what I would have done.
But it does underline sort of like how the rest of the episodes proceeds. Like, well, they did play better. I mean, he should have had the eye of the tiger if he knew that he potentially could have been a target.
Yeah.
He should have been out there like Keith. Keith knew that he had to have it.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'd forgotten also how hardcore Alicia was. Oh my God.
Oh my God.
Those guns, especially since at this stage, she probably would have lost quite a bit of muscle tone, but she was really jacked.
Yeah. Her stomach is ridiculous.
And you can get a sense watching this episode versus what she turned into, how Elizabeth Hasselbeck became a public figure, because she's quite likable.
I remember, you know, it was when later in the season they, you know, vote Jerry out as opposed to Elizabeth, everyone thought this was like, you know, supreme karmic justice. And now, like, with Elizabeth looking back, it's like, oh, okay.
We didn't know.
But
back when she was Elizabeth Filarski, she was a different person.
It does go to show that your persona on a reality show has nothing to do necessarily with who you are in life, which is why, again, hurt feelings, you know, just don't have a place in the game.
No, it's true. But I definitely understand why you picked this episode. It does move, and I like the social aspects of it, of which there were a lot, especially from this at this early stage where it's like people weren't so jaded about it. Like this cast, certainly more so than the season one cast, had a sense of how things could go, but they also didn't know how to think like 50 moves ahead. Like they had some basic understanding, and I think the reason that they assumed that they were going to be merging or going to one team's beach was probably because that's what happened in season one.
And yeah, I didn't even think about that, but that's probably true.
But but then, like, now if you're on the show in season, you know, 59, you have a sense of like, nothing necessarily has to be the same as last season. There could be 17 twists in this one episode that no one can see coming. And so there's a kind of innocence to them, sort of like with the Amazing Race episode that we were discussing a couple of weeks ago, that made this very enjoyable to watch. A lot of great personalities. You can't cast people like this anymore because they don't exist. The people that are like this don't want to be on reality shows because they know how it can fuck up their lives. So it was a pleasure to revisit this one.
I thought this episode had a slow start. I don't think much happened. I think the meat of this episode, like, this episode doesn't get really interesting until just before the actual merge, where people are really kind of going over things in their head, and then the pillar challenge, and then obviously, you know, everybody's, you know, wringing their hands over exactly what's going to happen at council. And, you know, to be honest, I thought the vote at the end, you know, you knew how it was going to shake out, you know, a good 20 minutes before tribal council was there. It was inevitable. So the actual end minutes of this episode are a bit, you know, as a thing of entertainment. You know, you could have written that better somehow.
Other than Jeff's final comments, it does kind of peter out.
It does.
The council is a little bit anticlimactic.
Yeah. So this brings up the question for me, like, how rewatchable is a reality show? And for me, not very. I'm not a big reality show guy, even less so than you, John, you were saying at the beginning. I do remember really liking Survivor at the time and really being into it. But going back to it didn't do anything for me, because I knew generally what was going to happen. And, you know, for these kind of things, I think, you know, it's in the moment, it's the choices people make, and it's the results that are interesting, especially for, you know, a game that lasts 13 episodes more. Yeah. And it didn't captivate me the second time around. Sarah?
I wasn't necessarily that captivated by it, but I think if you had to show one episode from the entire series run to whatever, an alien race, you would pick this one because it wasn't quite as like, herky and trying to find its footing as season one. But it's also like this wonderful reminder that, first of all, there were still real people who would go on it who weren't model bartenders back then.
I just wanted to add to that exactly what you're saying is the nice thing about this episode too is the challenge is like real, and it's not like a game of mousetrap, which a lot of them are in the later seasons. They become more and more complex. To speak to your point, sir.
Yeah, that there's, you're allowed to have a little more nuance as a human being who has been outside for 3 weeks, has not been able to shave her pits, and is not constantly on the hunt for immunity idols or trying to, you know, strategize based on so many variables. Like, it was a pretty simple game. Outwit, yeah. Outplay, outlast. That's it. Not like sit in a hammock, you know, away from civilization, a la Sugar, or be a Hance, or have a personality disorder. And I seem to remember, like, Jerry being this really intensely disliked mega bitch figure. But she's actually just, you know, she's just a direct person.
By later standards, it's like, it's nothing.
Well, it's like Team Guido in that Amazing Race episode we talked about.
Yeah, it's like were we ever so young?
Right.
So based on the fact that this really shows what a good basic idea Survivor is and indicates that it probably has survived not because of all the, like, added on garbage in the interim, but in spite of it. And because Survivor was, like, really the thing that launched competitive reality shows of this and most other ilks, you know, was it riveting? Not particularly, but I think I tend to vote just as much for canon entries based on how quintessential they are of their show and their genre. So,
all right. Well, before don't give away your vote, Sarah, because we have to do this. Okay. We have to do this properly. I got to take this. I'll vote first.
I was so hoping you were going to do this, Dave. I can't even tell you.
Writing it down. Tara, can you now vote? Write it down on that piece of paper.
Shake head for vote.
Oh, Jesus.
What?
Yes, shake head for vote, Tara.
Sorry. I vote yes. I don't know what I'm supposed to do.
All right.
We did not rehearse this.
And Sarah, you might as well now say your vote.
I vote yes.
All right. I voted no, but that means two votes yes, one vote no. You are hereby inducted into the extra hot Great Canyon. Survivor Season 2, Episode 7, The Merge. You are hereby inducted, yep, into the extra hot Great Canyon.
Do you want to redo it so we can
Americans
have it properly?
Shut up!
And we'll not tolerate a loser.
Nope!
It's time for Winner and Loser of the Week. And Tara, who's our winner?
Our winner is not me. It's Cheerios. They took a lot of heat for having a couple of ads with an interracial family, and people were bigots on YouTube and made shitty comments. And instead of pulling the ad, Cheerios went, fuck you, to all the bigots and revived the family for not just any ad, but their Super Bowl ad. So way to go, Cheerios.
Awesome. Loser of the week?
Loser of the week is Dr. Phil, who is being sued again by the family of a client claiming false imprisonment. I don't know if anyone remembers this, but Lori Bambi Bembenek, the late Bambi Bembenek, sued or threatened to sue Dr. Phil and his producers and claimed that they kept her in a room while she was taping the show, which is why she had to jump out a window, which is why she had part of a leg amputated. I always just assumed that Bembenek was kind of crazy. Whatever, Google her. She's at the center of a pretty famous true crime story.
Yep.
From 30 years ago, but I just assumed that she was like kind of bonkaloo. But this isn't the first or even the third time that someone has accused Dr. Phil of keeping them somewhere against their will, either for treatment they didn't want that proved injurious or just to tape the show. So, hey, Dr. Phil, there's really not a shortage of fame whores in this country. Tell your producers that if people want to leave, give them cab fare and get them the fuck out of there so you don't get sued.
Nice.
Guys, you know what time
That's
it
what
is?
She said.
It's game time.
It's game time. All right, everybody, this is the fifth game time of the season. Tara has 3 points. Sarah has 1 point. The guests have yet to put a point on the board. Maybe this is the week. Today, we are playing Relative Uncertainty from Andrea C.
Interesting.
Uh-oh.
Andrea C. earns herself an extra credit For this submission, extra credits, of course, are redeemable for an extra hot, great mini topic of her choosing. Today's game will test your knowledge of TV family trees. I am going to read you the name of a TV character and a relationship. For example, Fox Mulder's sister. You give me the name of that character for 1 point. Anybody?
Samantha.
Samantha Mulder. And the show in question for another point.
The X-Files.
That would be 2 points. We have 36 questions. Let's see who Picky wants to go first.
We will start with valued guest.
All right. So valued guest, you go first. Then we'll go to Tara sitting right next to you and then over to Sarah in New York. Are we ready to play Relative Uncertainty?
Sure.
Okay.
No, brother.
All right. John, Ferguson Darling's sister. Ferguson Darling's sister. Got a couple tough ones to start this game off, which is the way it rolled out.
I mean, Darling is the only Darling I can think of is Dirty Sexy Money, but I don't remember a Ferguson, so that's probably not right.
The character in question, Clarissa Darling from the show Clarissa Explains It All.
Oh, I would have assumed Dirty Sexy Money too.
Not all.
Tara.
Yeah.
Only some, apparently.
Tess Ross's mother. Tess Ross's mother. Character and show.
Is the show Roswell?
That is Carol Hathaway from ER.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Sarah knew that one. All right, Sarah. Yep. Francis.
Won't know this one.
Francis Valo. Valo? V-A-L-O-I-S. Half-brother.
Valois.
Francis Valois. Half-brother.
Half-brother?
Ah, oui.
Benson.
Nope, sorry, wrong button.
That's so mean.
Yeah, sorry.
For you, Blake.
No,
and
it's because, I had the buttons in the wrong place.
Is it Bastion from Rain?
It is. Bastion Dupontier. All right, so we're back to John.
No. Yep.
This is a tough one, John, especially for you.
Man.
Sherlock Holmes' brother. Going to need the character and the show.
Mycroft Holmes, Sherlock.
Correct for 2 points. All right, Tara.
Yep.
Rudy Huxtable's brother.
Theo Huxtable on The Cosby Show.
2 points. All right. Elliot Stabler's father.
Oh, Christ. Mr. Stabler.
This might be one
of... Law and Order SVU. George Stabler.
Good guess, though.
Elliot Stabler's father is Elliot Stabler.
Oh, come on.
Rude.
It was Mr. Stabler, bastards.
John.
That's what she said.
Lemon Breland's cousin. Lemon Breland's cousin.
No idea.
Tara?
Well, the show is Heart of Dixie, but I don't know what her cousin's name is.
Jonah Breland.
Okay.
Jonah Breland. All right. Tara.
Yep.
Christopher Hayden's daughter.
Rory Gilmore of Gilmore Girls.
2 points. Sarah. Hillary.
Yes.
Hillary Banks' cousin. Hillary Banks' cousin.
Hillary Banks' cousin?
Yep.
I don't know the cousin, but I'm going to go Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Nice.
So who was her cousin?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Banks. Sorry.
Back to John. Joey Potter's sister.
Oh, my God. What's her name? The show is Dawson's Creek.
1 point.
Bessie.
Nice. Nice pull.
Oh, God.
Right.
Tara.
Yes.
Mind Palace, that one.
Yeah, seriously. Jail.
Marcia. Yeah.
Marcia Brady.
Marcia. God. Husband.
Oh, I don't know, but the show is The Brady Wives.
Close, it rhymes.
Brides.
Brides.
I think his name, no, I don't know.
Wally.
That's it, yes. I could picture him.
So disgusted.
Me too. Oh, the worst.
Do you know the last name?
Kill ourselves, good.
Can you give us a last name for super Dave points? Logan.
No, Gunderson.
No, that's a good guess. All right, back to
Sarah.
Sarah, Jeff Winger's father.
Jeff Winger's father, Kip Winger.
Nope.
On Wings.
I would have guessed Wings too.
William Winger on Community. That's
Yeah, never gonna know that one.
All right, John.
Yes.
Chachi Arcola's cousin.
Arcola.
Arcola. That's right. No I there.
E. coli.
Did you say Chachi?
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's Happy Days. And his cousin was the Fonz?
2 points.
Nice.
All right, Tara. Mm-hmm. Georgette Walsh's grandson. Georgette Walsh's grandson.
Brandon Walsh on Beverly Hills 90210. Oh.
2 points. All right.
The pressure was on that one.
Yeah. I don't remember their ever saying her name, but sure. Oh my gosh.
Lily Aldrin's father. This is for Sarah. Lily Aldrin's father.
Lily Aldrin's father.
Ugh. Character in the show.
Buzz Aldrin on How I Met Your Mother.
1 point for How I Met Your Mother.
Is his name Mitch?
Mickey.
Mickey.
Close. But you got the show, so you got 1 point.
Yep.
No love for the puns.
That's the Chris Elliott character, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. And I'll let you know ahead of time. This is a bit of a clue, but won't be much of a clue once I start reading. I'm going to need a qualifier for the show. Okay? The character, okay. I mean, the we're looking for is Bobby Ewing's nephew. And I just want to know which version of the show. So I need the character and the show. Bobby Ewing's nephew is, and the show from.
Well, I don't know the nephew's name, so let's. I'll say Bobby too. But,
okay. Show.
Show is Dallas New Version.
1 point. Answer: J.R. John Ross Ewing.
Yes.
All right, number 17 for Tara.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Brad Barone's brother.
Ray Barone on Everybody Loves Raymond.
2 points. Sarah. Colin Hart's sister. Colin Hart's sister.
Colin Hart's sister. Colin
Character Hart's and sister. The show.
The show is Everwood.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, damn. Why can't... well, Emily?
Lainey.
Those
Lainey Hart.
Oh, right.
It was Nora Zehetner when she was in everything. Yep. Right.
All right. For John. Your last question before the score break. Julia Sugarbaker's sister. Julia Sugarbaker's sister. Character and the show.
Mark Blankenship would kill me. It's Designing Women, obviously.
And the character. Julia Sugarbaker's sister is... The following, which John will now say.
It's got to be Delta Burke, right? But I can't remember. Fuck. I don't remember.
Suzanne.
Yeah.
Oh.
Suzanne Sugarbaker. But that's not Delta Burke, right? That's the
blonde.
Yeah, it is. Oh, it is. Okay.
Julia was Dixie Carter.
No, I was thinking that was the blonde, but...
Oh, that's Jean Smart.
Oh, okay.
They were not really good. Yes.
Tara.
Yes.
Larry's brothers.
Daryl and Daryl on Newhart.
2 points.
Nice.
All right.
Should be 3 points.
Yeah. All right. And for Sarah.
Sarah.
Yes. Aaron Hotchner's wife. Aaron Hotchner's wife. Hotchner's wife. Good luck.
I have no idea on either count.
Haley Hotchner from Criminal Minds.
Of those I've never watched. Okay. Sorry.
All right. So I say, let's find out the score.
Sarah has 4. John has 8. I have 10.
All right. So now we go into round 2.
Oh, no.
Oh, shit.
I will give you... The clue.
Yes.
There are 2 answers for each for a possible 3 points.
Got it.
Ooh.
All right. So this is for John. Randy Taylor's brothers. 2 brothers for Randy Taylor.
Randy Taylor.
The game could be made here. Lots of points to lose and gain. Got a clue?
No.
Brad and Mark Taylor from Sarah.
Home Improvement.
Yeah, right. I couldn't have said either of the other kids for $1,000.
I would have guessed the actors' names.
Yes.
And sadly, I would have been right.
I know their names.
The characters.
Mm-hmm. All right, so this is for Tara.
Yep.
Laura Spencer's children.
Spencer.
Spencer. White wine Spencer. Spencer.
Laura Spencer's children.
Yep.
I'm going to say the show is General Hospital. Do not know their names.
Lucky and Lulu. Good old Lucky
Sorry,
and Lulu.
Everybody.
God.
Jesus.
All right. Sarah?
Yes.
Charlotte Grayson's parents.
Ah.
Oh, thank you. Victoria and Conrad Grayson on Revenge.
3 points. Nice. All right, John. Herb Powell's nieces. Herb Powell's nieces.
Don't know.
Lisa and Maggie.
And Maggie Simpson from The Simpsons.
Oh, Herb Powell.
Oh. Yeah, Herb Powell. And that's an error I caught. Error I caught in the thing. What I just want to like I was looking up for
the,
you guys.
What was the error?
It said Herb Simpsons, but
oh.
I put that.
Oh.
All right. So this is for Sarah.
Nope.
No, it's for Tara.
Yep.
My
yep.
other wife. Okay.
Yes.
Stu Pickle's sons.
The show is Rugrats.
1 point.
And wow. His sons are the nasal one.
Mm-hmm.
Tyler and Elias. I don't know.
Tommy Pickles and Dylan Dill Pickles.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
yeah. Oh, Dill.
Dill Pickles. Nice.
Okay. Now it's Sarah's.
Now it's Sarah's.
Okay.
Yes.
Here
other
you go.
Other way.
Mary Camden's sisters.
Oh.
Ugh.
Oh, okay. Well, the show is Seventh Heaven. There's one named Ruthie.
Yep. What was the other one's name?
What was the blonde one's name? I know the actress's name. Beverly.
God damn it. The world's youngest Beverly.
Is it Lucy?
It is Lucy.
Lucy.
The world's youngest Beverly.
Lucy had a steamboat.
I think it's Beverly's the actress's name, right?
Yes.
Beverly Mitchell.
Yeah, it
Beverly
is.
Mitchell.
Yeah. Mitchell.
Yeah.
Okay, John.
Whatever happened to
Alicia Florek's children? Alicia Florek's children. Show and two character names.
Alicia Florek's. I don't know.
I'm surprised you don't watch this show.
What is it?
It's The Good Wife.
And no, I don't actually.
Do you know
I've been meaning to catch up.
The children's
Zach.
Yep. And
what's the Jesus-y daughter's name?
Yeah, what is her name?
Well,
Grace.
Yeah.
Yes.
Good name for a Jesus-y daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tara.
Yes.
Sabrina Spellman's aunts.
The show is Sabrina the Teenage Witch. And her aunts are Hazel. And.
Good guess. I mean, with a name like Sabrina Spellman, Hazel's a really good guess for a witch.
Sure.
Bernice.
Also a good guess.
Oh my God, what if that was
I've
right?
Gone Mabel.
Zelda and Hilda.
Zelda!
Zelda and
can
Hilda.
You can see where I got the Z from.
All right, age. Going into our score break.
Yep.
For Sarah, Laura, yes. Laura Winslow's siblings. Laura Winslow's siblings.
Laura Winslow's siblings. Yeah. I don't have the first damn idea.
The show Family Matters. The characters Eddie and Judy. Eddie and
okay,
sure. Judy.
Things have switched up in this round.
All right.
John has 8, Sarah has 9, I have 13.
All right. Round 3, you each got 2 questions here in round 3. 3 answers.
What?
3 answers
no.
here. And so we're going to go back to John. Are you ready?
Yeah.
I'm going to murder this name, but I think you're all going to know who it is. Jesse Katz...
Katsopoulos?
Yes. Jesse Kassopoulos' nieces for John.
Not a show I watch.
No clue at all?
I'm going to guess Community since I don't watch it.
Incorrect. Sort of. The show?
It's Full House.
Full House.
Yeah. Okay. So can you give me the nieces?
DJ?
Yep.
Stephanie?
Yep.
And Michelle.
That's right.
Oh, God.
Wow.
I'm going to etch those on my tombstone.
Okay, Tara.
You got it, dude.
Here's your first round three question.
Yep.
Henry Mills' parents.
Henry Mills has three parents? Henry Mills' parents.
Apparently.
I'm going to guess the show is Once Upon a Time. Ah!
Wow.
Okay, so one of his parents is Mary Margaret or Snow White. One of them is, her last name is Swan. It's the main girl that's played by the girl from House.
Gonna need a character name here, Tara.
Oh. Susan. I don't know who the last one is. Rumpelstiltskin.
Neil? Now, those, you know, the nursery rhyme things might be right, but that's not what we're looking for.
No, I know.
Neil Cassidy, Emma Swan.
Emma!
Regina Mills.
Regina, right.
Regina Mills. Okay. For Sarah.
Sarah.
I know who you are.
Do you?
Sarah Baseball.
Yes.
Leonard Green's daughters. Leonard Green's daughters.
Leonard Green's daughters. So. I don't actually know, but... You never know. You might get lucky. Charmed?
That's a good guess.
A good I don't know.
Lay some knowledge on us, Star.
Leonard Green.
Yeah. Green.
Oh, Rachel.
Yeah.
Jill.
Oh. Yep.
And what was the other one?
What was the other one? The other one was Hilda. Amy.
Amy, the Christine Applegate one from Friends.
From Friends, yes.
Right.
Okay, so you just got one question, so let's just do... The score.
Okay. John has 8. Sarah has 9. I have now 14.
14. Looks like it's
okay.
Out of grasp, but let's do it. For John, Adam Braverman's nieces. Adam Braverman's nieces.
Still don't know.
That was Parenthood. Parenthood. Amber. Sydney. And
the rest.
Yeah.
The other one.
I lost my place. Yeah.
I guess that's a good guess. But.
I forget what the baby's name is.
Oh, it's... I really did lose my place. Oh, fuck it. We'll come
Doesn't
back.
Matter.
All right. Tara.
Yes. Yes.
Stephen Douglas's sons. Stephen Douglas's sons.
I have no idea.
There's three of them.
Yeah. Is the show My Three Sons?
Yep.
I don't know. Chip, it was Sarah, right? Chip?
Richard, yeah, Chip.
Sarah.
Biff.
No. Nope.
I only knew Chip.
Chip, Robbie, and...
Cable Guy.
All right.
Chip, Robbie, and Michael Douglas.
Sure.
Michael Douglas. And our last one for Sarah, and this might be a nice little way to end it. Shirley Partridge's sons.
Sons. Okay, I believe that is the Partridge Family.
1 point.
Yay! Keith.
2 points.
Chris.
3 points.
And the shittiest one.
And the douche. What was the douche's name? Shit. Danny?
Yep!
Oh, that was so close. So
I got within a point.
Within 1 point. Tara. All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We examine the third fan service heavy series of Sherlock before going around the dial with stops at Helix, Carrie Diaries, and America Horror Story, and
True Detective.
True Detective. Thank you, John. John brought us the second season episode of Survivor, The Merge, which was brought before the Extra Hot Canon Council and inducted into it. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
I lick your face.
Sarah D. Bunting.
I can't top that.
And John Ramos.
Miss me?
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
That's what she said.
Thank you.
You!
Your face!
Utter!
Your face!
You!
Totally had you.
You cock! I knew it! I knew it!
You said such sweet things. I never knew you cared.
You know, I will kill you if you ever breathe a word of this...
Scouts on it.
...to anyone! You knew! You knew how to turn it off!
There's an off switch. There's always an off switch.